morning, which is Davis versus Venata.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Murray, and I'm here on behalf of petitioner appellant Anthony Davis. This is a case where having two attorneys turned out to be the equivalent of having no attorney at all. Neither of Davis's attorneys understood what their roles were in this case, and ultimately neither of them took responsibility for preparing his defense. On the morning of Davis's trial, when his designated lead attorney failed to appear, his other attorney, Zook, proceeded without him. However, there had been no independent investigation on behalf of Davis before trial. There had been no interviews with any potential witnesses. No witnesses had been subpoenaed. There had been no depositions of any of the prosecution's witnesses. In fact, Zook had only met with Davis two or three times beforehand, and the only preparation he had done beforehand was reviewing the police file. The Supreme Court has held that where counsel is precipitated into a case immediately before trial and there's been no preparation done beforehand, counsel is presumed to be an ineffective adversary, an ineffective advocate. The court has held that the likelihood that counsel could have performed under such circumstances as an effective adversary is so remote as to have made the trial inherently unfair. That's what happened in this case, and it therefore falls squarely under the United States Supreme Court's decisions in U.S. versus Chronic and Powell versus Alabama. However, the state courts refused to consider Davis's presumed prejudice claims on their merits. Therefore, the state's adjudication of his claims are contrary to and an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, and his petition should have been granted.
Now, was it the trial itself that where there's this lack of, or I guess under Chronic, complete lack of representation, or was it the preliminary parts? What was missing? What didn't the counsel do that he should have done?
Well, this case is a perfect example for why counsel, when the counsel takes responsibility for the case immediately before trial, and there's been no preparation. While the surrounding circumstances limit the counsel's ability to be an effective advocate. In this case, the prosecution had only one witness who was going to testify.
That was a police officer who engaged in some undercover drug transactions with the defendant.
That's right.
What was the defense?
I'm sorry?
What was the defense?
The defense presented by Zook was essentially that the prosecution needed to be held to its burden of proof. There were no...
Was there another defense lurking there someplace that he overlooked?
Neither of Davis's attorneys, Borges or Zook, had ever taken responsibility for investigating whether there was a defense. Neither
Did you look into it yourself?
I have not gathered evidence on it myself, Your Honor.
The fact is there is no indication of what he would have put forth if an investigation had been complete.
Your Honor, the evidentiary record in this case has only been developed with respect to a presumed prejudice claim.
I understand what you're saying, but I was trying to get at, was there some basis for thinking that if he had looked someplace, he would have found a defense?
In retrospect, it's only speculation whether or not. None of the potential... There were at least two other individuals who Officer Snyder said were present at the transactions. There was a confidential informant and an absent co-defendant, Gregory Hunt, who was evidently not charged with these specific instances. Neither of these individuals was interviewed or deposed beforehand. During post-conviction proceedings, Zook admitted that he never even considered talking to the confidential informant beforehand.
Now, it's my understanding that Strickland applies in ineffective assistance cases when the defendant actually had a lawyer at the critical stages, and here he did. So why wouldn't Strickland apply instead of Kronik?
Actually, Your Honor, in both Powell versus Alabama and in Kronik, actually Powell versus Alabama is the case most on point, the defendants in that case did have attorneys who were appointed to represent them.
Well, that's the potted plant kind of situation. But here, the lawyer, Zook, was a fairly experienced, he was a public defender, wasn't he?
Yes.
And his defense was, make the government prove it, make the state prove it. And I don't see that there was any other defense that was possible here.
Under these circumstances, where Zook ultimately became responsible for the defense just immediately before trial, he didn't even have the opportunity to investigate, for example, whether or not there was a possibility or any evidence to support an entrapment defense. He hadn't talked to anyone about any of the others involved in the case. He had never had the opportunity to investigate whether there might be some prior history between Davis and Officer Schneider that might have given Officer Schneider a motive to testify falsely or inaccurately against Davis. He didn't even have the opportunity to attempt to impeach Officer Schneider's testimony with a deposition because none had ever been taken. Those are some of the things that he couldn't do under the circumstances because he became responsible for the case immediately before trial. Certainly any attorney who had an opportunity to prepare would at least want to look into those options, but there's no evidence that any attorney in this case ever had that opportunity or at least undertook responsibility for doing it before trial.
The Indiana Court of Appeals said that Zook had decided to proceed to trial, or not Zook, but your client, your appointed client, had decided to proceed to trial with Zook, not ask for a continuance, although Zook had asked for one. Am I correct? Are they correct in that?
Davis was given two options on the morning of trial. He could either go forward then with Zook, or he was given, there was a suggestion of a continuance, but it was only for the limited purpose of allowing Borges and another opportunity to appear. Those were the only options suggested to him.
Well, it would have the effect, however, of letting Zook figure out more to do, but your guy decided he wanted to proceed to trial with Zook.
No one ever suggested to Davis that morning that if he accepted a continuance, he might be able to proceed with Zook, taking more
responsibility. So did you think that the statement by the appellate court of Indiana was incorrect in saying that Zook, that your client had elected to proceed to trial?
I think that he declined a continuance to wait for to see if Borges would finally...
Well, waiting for Borges would have the incidental effect of giving Zook an opportunity to do whatever investigation might be available, assuming there was anything he could find anyway.
Certainly, benefit of hindsight, I might believe that, and you might believe that, but there's no suggestion that Davis believed that.
Well, the suggestion is that Davis... written by the court, said that they found that Davis had elected to proceed to trial. And our problem is whether or not there's anything in the record that makes that sound sappy. And if there isn't, we're stuck with it, aren't we?
Whether or not he elected to proceed to trial still doesn't answer the question of whether...
Yeah, well, at least for that one thing, we'd have to accept their word.
Yes. I'll see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Fine. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court because the Indiana Court of Appeals correctly concluded that Mr. Davis did have effective representation at trial. And specifically in this case, that is the issue. Did Mr. Davis enjoy effective representation of counsel at trial, not whether Attorney Borges, who clearly just failed to do anything on petitioner's behalf, was ineffective, because every court that's reviewed this case to this point is in agreement that Mr. Borges is horrendously deficient. The problem with petitioner's argument at this stage is it fails to acknowledge the fact that despite the fact that his chosen counsel failed to represent him in any kind of professional manner. Mr. Zook stepped in and did an admirable job. And
when did Zook get involved in the case at all? My recollection was at the bond hearing level.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
how much before the trial was that?
It was, I want to say, in June of 94, and I would probably defer to Mr. Murray in terms of dates, mm-hmm. but I think he would agree that Mr. Zook had become involved very early. And if you look at petitioner's supplemental appendix, you will see that early in the proceedings, there was a witness, and again, I'm sorry that this potential witness's name has escaped me. There was a witness that Mr. Davis had wished to call at trial. And in fact, an order was filed to make arrangements for that witness's transport because he was an incarcerated witness. And that order, or that motion rather, had been filed by Mr. Zook. This was before he had been appointed as local interim counsel. And that's where petitioner is at this point, and understandably so, because if you look at Mr. Zook's representation, there's just nothing to talk about after the state courts get finished with it. So instead, understandably, petitioner invokes the holding of Chronic and says that pretrial, I was not taken care of pretrial. However, it's his burden in post-conviction in the state courts, and it's his burden on habeas review to show what it was that counsel should have done that he didn't do pretrial, or that he did that damaged him pretrial.
One thing that's not really gone into, and perhaps it's because it's not what would maybe label a critical stage, but I was confused. This is a pretty long sentence. I recall it's about 40 years, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. And I don't know how much. It says over 3 grams. It doesn't sound like a lot to me. But
that's Indiana's threshold amount to qualify as an A felony.
Okay. Anyway, maybe it was a lot more than that. But there was some discussion about, very vague, about a plea agreement. And apparently with that, what's his name, Borges or whatever his name is, the first lawyer sort of touched on it, and they thought it was only 12 or 20 years, but they couldn't agree on something. There was an impasse. Now, I don't know if that's really not, I don't think you, ineffective assistance comes whether or not you don't have a right to a plea agreement. But at the same time, I'm just wondering where that went, and was there some possibility of getting a much shorter sentence?
My only knowledge about that incident at this time, my recollection, Your Honor, but I do recall this clearly, that in open court, in the presence of Mr. Zook and Mr. Davis and counsel for the state, there was a discussion about a potential plea. The state had represented on the record with all those parties present that there had been an agreement about a charge to plead to, but that there had been an impasse reached with regard to what the appropriate amount of time served for that charge would be appropriate. Neither Mr. Davis nor Mr. Zook took any issue with that characterization of the state of affairs. And the court said to Mr. Davis, today's the day. And Mr. Davis declined to accept whatever offer was on the table from the state. And under those circumstances, I think it's crucially...
There was something there that he rejected then.
Yes, and I think it's crucially incumbent upon Davis under those circumstances to tell us what Mr. Zook should have done under those circumstances to more palatably barter that plea bargain, or to make it something that the state and Mr. Davis could agree on. What was it he should have done?
Well, I'm not sure that even meets the critical stage. I'm just mostly curious about whether or not where that was, and I think you've explained it.
And I would just like to summarize that Mr. Zook testified in post-conviction that he'd reviewed the state's discovery, which he also had characterized as fairly extensive or substantial, that he knew the state's police witness and was familiar with him and felt confident about his ability to cross-examine him, had reviewed the laboratory reports, and told the court in post-conviction that he always had a reason to take issue with chain of custody issues, but that he didn't see anything in the reports that made that a a viable way to attack the state's case, and that he was prepared. He told the trial court at trial that he was prepared to go forward. He said the same thing in post-conviction. So his consistent account of his readiness held up at trial and then later at post-conviction. Mr. Davis just offers, invites the court actually to speculate about what might not have happened, that should have happened, and he had a burden in state court, he had a burden in the district court.
Well, Mr. Murray tells us that maybe there's a possibility of an entrapment defense or something here that could have been pursued by Mr. Zook. What does the record tell us about that? First of all, if he had any record, probably not going to be successful with an entrapment defense.
To my knowledge, Your Honor, there's no evidence that, and that's the problem. There's no evidence of that. Was it potential? Was it possible? I suppose it is, unless we find out otherwise. But there's nothing in the record. In the Indiana Court of Appeals conclusion that Zook had been effective is supported by the record. And I think very telling, in appellant's reply brief, he says, this court shouldn't credit Zook's accounts in post-conviction after the fact that his recollections about what Borges had said to him may not be accurate. And I think that kind of sums up where we are in this case, which is that the Indiana Court of Appeals made decisions based on evidence that's in the record. It's inappropriate at this point to reassess Counsel Zook's credibility, and it's too late for him to make his case, and I would suggest that the reason why he hasn't made it to this late date is because there's nothing there to make it with. This is not chronic. This is Strickland, and he failed to show deficient performance or prejudice. So he was properly denied habeas relief. And I would just like to add one more thing about the procedural posture of the case, just to clarify what seems to be a misunderstanding about Indiana's application of res judicata to ineffective assistance claims that are raised on post-conviction after a defendant has raised that claim on direct appeal. It is not a finding that that claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel had been heard on the merits and adjudicated, therefore the court would not revisit the issue, as is commonly understood when the term res judicata is used. Rather, it is that when you elect to raise it on direct appeal, you are required to raise every factual predicate and permutation of deficiency and the prejudice that resulted from that at that time, or forever hold your peace. So it is indeed a procedural bar, and it constitutes an independent and adequate state law ground.
What was the ineffective assistance issue raised before the state court that that addresses ineffective assistance, but was not? But then another part was not raised. I guess that's the point. They raised ineffective assistance, but didn't cover the gamut on ineffective assistance. Is that it?
As petitioner correctly points out, Mr. Davis did invoke chronic extensively on post-conviction review, and the issue we take with that is that he didn't say that he was deprived of counsel at a critical stage at that time, and that was his basis for chronic. He just offered chronic asking the court to find that there was some kind of a structural impediment to effective assistance. That's not the same claim. Now, what the Indiana Court of Appeals adjudicated was Mr. Zook's effectiveness under Washington v. Strickland, I'm sorry. And it was rather an easy adjudication for them to make, because then, as now, all this time later and with these opportunities for subsequent review, Mr. Davis raised no allegations of deficient performance, nor did he allege any prejudice.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Murray.
Thank you.
A couple of the questions were addressed to Mr. Martin. he was asked when Zook became first involved in representing Davis. That was shortly after his arrest in 1994. I believe it was April 14th. He was appointed to represent him at a bond hearing. The only thing he did was he appeared at a bond hearing, and then he filed a motion to continue the upcoming pretrial conference.
Well, you assume he talked to him at the bond hearing or before the bond hearing?
At least briefly before the bond hearing.
Yeah.
One of the issues at the bond hearing was whether or not what exactly previous prior convictions Davis had.
Yeah.
A report came back listing a number of convictions that Davis contended were not actually his. There was some brief discussion during the hearing about that. That issue, in fact, was never resolved.
Yeah.
2 years later when he was sentenced, no one had ever followed up on that and tried to resolve it. Zook was therefore officially on the case for about 2 weeks at that point. With respect to...
There was somebody named Tate?
There was Elizabeth Tate.
This other guy had to have a local counsel.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and so when Tate then got out of the picture, Zook came back in as sort of an interim local counsel or something. Rather.
That's right. After her motion of withdrawal was granted, Borges was ordered to have local counsel. He didn't do it. He failed to appear for a couple of status hearings. And finally, Judge Duffin appointed Zook as interim local counsel. Zook, I think, at one point testified that he thought that his appointment was permanent unless Borges hired someone, but that's exactly what Judge Duffin's order told him to do, was to hire someone. So it's clear that Zook was in there until that was done. With respect to his... I see that my time is up, there are any other questions. With respect to why there's no record concerning a specific prejudice claim, Davis has actually never had an opportunity to offer evidence on that. After his direct appeal, at the time of his direct appeal, the rule in Indiana, or at least one of the rules, was that if he didn't raise a claim on direct appeal, it would be considered waived for post-conviction proceedings. Therefore, he raised a Strickland claim to protect it. However, after his direct appeal was decided, the Indiana Supreme Court decided in 1998 that it was no longer going to apply that rule with respect to assistance of counsel claims. Those could be preserved and raised for the first time in post-conviction proceedings. But the court also held that if any assistance claim was raised on direct appeal, then it couldn't be revisited in post-conviction proceedings, and it would be res judicata. Therefore, right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Your Honor. Thanks very much. In case we take under advisement. I understand you were court-appointed. Is that right, Mr. Murray? You were court-appointed?
Yes.
I appreciate your taking the assignment and doing a good job for your client.